The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
It is, and it's a Wednesday. Welcome to it. I'm Nicole Sandler, coming to you live at NicoleSandler.com on the Progressive Voices Network, streaming video on YouTube and Facebook and Twitter and Twitch. I think we're on the Progressive Voices Network. Something doesn't look quite right here, but hopefully it's working. Anyway, welcome. There we go. All right, it's on. Welcome to what day is today? Wednesday. I'm sorry, I'm having a rough day. Really am. There's so much going on. And to be honest with you, for most of the show today, we're getting away from it. Because every now and then, I don't know about you, but I need an escape. So first, the good news, right? California, thank you. As a friend of mine who lives in California just posted on Facebook a little while ago, marking myself safe from California becoming Florida. And to which I replied, you know, some of us are still stuck here in Florida. California voted, and they said to the Republicans who wanted to steal the governor's seat away from the Democrats said to the Republicans who wanted to steal the audio out, audio on. Audio is on. Isn't audio on? Oh, man. Come on. Yeah, the audio is on. Don't scare me like that. You voted to overwhelmingly, like 2-1, to say Gavin Newsom is the governor. He keeps his job. You can't come in and steal yet another seat from us. We're not going to allow that. And especially when you put up Larry Elder as the guy you think should take over. Really, it would have turned California into Florida and worse. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, California, for voting and doing the right thing. So at least we've got that going for us today. Today's been a weird day. Let me tell you, first of all, for those who asked about my plumbing, it sucks. Our living room, I took a picture of it, but yeah, I'm not going to, yeah, it's not, I didn't upload it or anything. We have a lovely hole that's got to be about, yeah, I'd say 3 feet high by 3 feet wide, right in the living room in the wall that leads to the hall bathroom where there's a leak somewhere. And they couldn't find the leak. So basically what they did was, make a long story short, I don't know. They drilled down into the ground, so the water now will run down into the ground instead of under the foundation of the house. Don't ask. I don't know. All I know is, you know, we have a bathroom that we can't use and water everywhere. So there's that. I'm kind of blown away by the reaction to the first revelations from the new book that's coming out next Tuesday from Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. It's called Peril. And it details, you know, the final days of Trump's reign of terror as he was occupying the White House and showed no inclination to accept the results of the election or to leave come January 20th. I was scared that January 20th was going to come and he was going to have to be carried out of the Oval Office. And actually, maybe that would have been a better thing, right? Maybe that would have been a better situation because then he would have been put away. But now the gaslighting continues. And so what we learned is what I said, actually not knowing this part of the story, I just knew that Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is the guy who kept us safe. Not necessarily safe from enemies foreign, but safe from enemies domestic, including the president and his administration. Mark Milley, we learn from this book, which I haven't seen yet because it's not out until Tuesday, but that he was on the line, on the phone with his counterpart in China saying, don't get rattled by what the former guy is saying. If there's going to be a strike, I will talk to you first. He made sure that he was in the, not necessarily chain of command, but in the information chain. So he knew what was coming down. He knew that Donald Trump was unhinged, was deranged, was manic in the wake of his loss, and couldn't be trusted. And he was afraid that this man was going to do something really stupid and deadly and either wage war with China or do something else really stupid. I know I was afraid of that. I wasn't in a position to stop him. Mark Milley was. Now, I know that in the military, and I've never been in the military, but there is a chain of command, and there is a directive, though, and this goes back to World War II, that you have a responsibility if you are being ordered to do something that you know is wrong, that you don't do it. And I believe that's what Mark Milley did. So I'm looking, you know, and I've tweeted a couple of times today. I believe Mark Milley is a hero. I really do. I just, not too long ago, I just said, General Mark Milley is a hero. I thank him profusely for saving us from a deranged madman who wouldn't accept that he lost the election. He's a hero. And then I see a long thread on Twitter shortly after I posted that from Steve Schmidt. Now, let's again review who Steve Schmidt is, please. I know he sounds great now. Well, except for this Twitter thread that I'm about to share with you. Because he's a never-Trumper. He sees the evil that lurks within. He's a former Republican strategist and campaign person. He ran John McCain's campaign. And let me say once again, he is responsible for Sarah fucking Palin. Yeah, I'm angry. I'm angry today. And so is Nicole Wallace, by the way. Now, she's got a nice, cushy perch at MSNBC, and Steve Schmidt is on the air there all the time. Let me share with you. He has this, I don't know how many parts this tweet is. It goes on and on and on. Some of them he numbered, some he didn't. But it starts off talking about Mark Milley. What a great his history during the last 20 years, starting with CIA officer Johnny Michael Spann, the first American killed in combat in Afghanistan, and including General Mark Milley's fellow Green Berets who charged the Taliban on horseback. The United States has placed hundreds of thousands of young Americans into impossible, treacherous, and lethal circumstances. Mark Milley, a Princeton graduate who volunteered to serve his country in uniform, has risen to the highest possible position in his chosen profession. He has commanded soldiers at every conceivable level, served in combat with valor, and has never done one thing of 41 years of uniformed service that would lead any person of good faith and goodwill to question his honor, commitment to duty, probity, rectitude, and loyalty to the United States. Yet, Steve Schmidt writes, the general finds himself in an impossible situation, surrounded by a phalanx of liars, hypocrites, grandstanders, and sunshine patriots who have betrayed their oaths, abandoned their commitment to democracy, and desecrated the blood sacrifices of 14 generations of American patriots. I agree with him up to this point. Then he says, well, I still agree with him even a little further, but he says he has become entangled in the toxic politics of Washington, where lesser men like Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, and dozens more can slander him at will on Rupert Murdoch's lie machine and watch that lie travel at the speed of light through a network of interconnected disinformation hubs. So far, so good, right? He continues, he is not unlike a young army captain trying to navigate a millennia of blood enemies in a mountainous Afghan village where she doesn't understand the culture, language, motives, history, or people she is facing. It is an utterly alien world. According to Peril by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, it appears that Milley did what he was trained to do. He improvised, adapted, and adjusted. He did what the young officers, NCOs and soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, and allied forces did for a generation and tried to solve problems and make things better. He continues, this is a moment where we face a reality that is particularly grim, given the advance of extremism, fascism, misinformation, and lunacy into every crevice of our culture. Though he committed no misconduct or dishonorable act, and that's where I part ways with Steve Schmidt, because his next sentence says, Millie must resign.
Bullshit.
He continues, sometimes there are consequences for doing the right thing. Sometimes the right thing to do involves breaking procedures, processes, and rules. Sometimes the circumstances are so exigent that bad choices become the best option in a menu of worse alternatives. Two things are crystal clear at this moment. One, more information and detail is required around the reporting in the book. The necessity for oversight hearings around these issues cannot be overstated. And two, he writes, Millie, through little fault of his own, has been politicized beyond repair. It is not fixable, though it is immediately recognizable. Civilian control of the U.S. military must remain sacrosanct. The U.S. military must remain not just above politics, but beyond it. It must be apolitical as a first virtue, and that virtue must be exampled by the senior uniformed office. Millie has done nothing wrong, but remaining in a post that will weaken the institution he has spent his life serving would be the wrong thing to do, and there's little evidence in the record of General Milley doing the wrong thing. And it goes on, but you get the gist of it. He's saying Milley did the right thing. He did nothing wrong, but he must resign? Hell no! He kept us safe, and I said this short weeks ago. I believe Mark Milley is the only reason we're still standing here in the United States of America with Joe Biden as president, because that coup attempt by Trump and his insurrectionist army came this close to succeeding for them. And all these fucking Republicans are going, oh, he's got to resign. He's got to be court-martialed. He disobeyed an order. Well, fuck you. Would you rather be living in Trump land right now? I'm just astounded. And I stick to my guns. Mark Milley is a hero. And if not for him, I shudder to think where we'd be right now. So I'm apoplectic, can you tell? So it's a good thing that I had to record this interview that we had scheduled for today earlier, because we were set for a live hit right now, really, with Bill Mumy and Angela Cartwright. And then I got an email like yesterday afternoon saying, Angela can't do it on Wednesday afternoon. Can we push it to another day? Or can we? I was like, no. How about we just tape it earlier in the day, which we did a couple of hours ago. And then all this shit started hitting the fan. It got me pissed off. So yeah, the whole thing about Milley. Yes, we do have a chain of command. And yes, we do have civilian control of the military. And I agree with those things. However, when the commander-in-chief is demented, is a deranged lunatic and a madman, I'm sorry, we need somebody to step up and take control. And thank God Mark Milley was there. All right, David, my husband, yes?
Yes, this is David, your husband.
Yeah.
So regarding Milley's situation,
yeah,
you know, the whole issue with the Nuremberg trials was who was to blame for the Holocaust, essentially.
Right.
And all of those people testified, I was just following
orders. Well,
and
you can't follow an order
that was, you should not follow an unjust order. An
exactly.
Order.
Exactly.
And that is exactly the position that Milley was in.
Yep.
He would have been asked to follow an unjust, illegal order, basically, and he refused to do it.
Yep.
And now these fucking shit stains want him to step down?
Uh-huh.
Fuck you.
Thank you. Yeah. We haven't even
in
talked
every
about this.
Hole, fuck you in every hole with a cactus, Steve Schmidt.
Thank you. Yeah, and Steve Schmidt is going on and on about how Mark Milley did the right thing here, but he must resign?
Bullshit.
I'm sorry. No,
why?
Steve
so
Schmidt, you
sort of
resign.
Lamb?
Yeah, of course, because so the Republicans can win again and say, see, we were right. They went rogue. Bullshit. They went rogue, and they're trying to turn this nation into a dictatorship, and they want Donald Trump back in charge? I don't think so.
No.
God.
No, absolutely not.
Yep. So, okay.
I was just following orders is not the way to go.
It's not an excuse.
And even though I have not served in the armed forces, I have heard often enough that if you are given an unjust, illegal order, you do not have to obey it.
That's right.
And maybe he took a little more initiative instead of waiting for that order to be given and then countermanding that order.
Yep.
But when you're dealing with a madman, which is what he was doing, you don't sit there and wait for the world to blow up and then say, oh, oops, I should have done
something. Right, exactly. So they would have him stand by and let Donald Trump complete his coup and take over control of everything and remain in office because he's committed a coup. I just don't get it. And I don't understand why the voices defending Milley aren't louder. I feel like I'm like a lone voice in a forest screaming out, he's a hero, he saved us.
Without a doubt. And I don't even know that it was necessarily the coup aspect of it that is the crux of the issue. The issue is, would Trump have ordered an attack on China or any other country in order to do a wag the dog?
Of course he would.
And stay in office. And exactly. You answered
the question. Of course he would. Of course he would. Without a second of hesitation, he would. And so,
without a doubt.
Right? And so Mark Milley, again, I will say, is the hero. Remember when the anonymous, you know, column came out in the New York Times and the book, and we're thinking, okay, so there's somebody there. Turned out to be a nobody. In fact, I've seen this guy over the last 24 hours interviewed a couple of times, and they say he was the chief of staff for the NSA or for the Homeland Security or something. They don't even mention that he was anonymous, the guy saying he'll protect us, because he didn't, and he wasn't in that position. Mark Milley was. Thank dog. Because
well,
I don't.
Well, wasn't anonymous that
Miles something. Yeah. And I've seen him on TV today, yeah, basically defending Milley, saying good that he did that. But they don't mention in either interview. And I saw him once on CNN and I think once on MSNBC. They did not even identify him as anonymous. So he's like, I guess, trying to get away from that because that was the wrong way to go about what he was trying to do. But he is speaking out very loudly, but he's one of the few voices. I want to hear from other like progressives defending Milley for standing up and protecting us.
Well, how about hearing it from, you know, the party of law and order, the party?
Well, that's not going to happen.
The defense-oriented party, the party supposedly is the adults in the room when it comes to foreign policy.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I won't hang by my thumbs waiting for that.
No, absolutely not. All right. Well, we're on the same page at least. I'd like to see some other people. I wonder what kind of response my tweet has gotten. Not a whole lot, frankly. You know, a few people have retweeted it.
Well, I don't think the good news is I don't think Milley's going anywhere.
I hope not. I hope he stays put. Because I trust him. I trust him to do the right thing, which is what we need. I don't want somebody who's going to follow orders blindly when those orders will put us in peril. We would be in Trump land now, I believe, if not for Milley.
I certainly trust him a lot more than I trust Steve Schmidt.
No
shit. And if we're talking about good judgment, let's measure what Milley did versus Schmidt.
Yeah. Schmidt gave us Sarah Palin.
Exactly.
That's all you need to know. And so did Nicole Wallace. Just, you know what? Yep. She's being touted as, you know, this great voice. MSNBC gave her 2 hours a day. She was the communications director for George W. Bush, who was one of the, you know, in the campaign for John McCain, working side by side with Steve Schmidt. They're the ones who gave us Sarah Palin. What more do you need?
Well, they tried to.
Well, they did. They foisted her on us into a national figure, And yeah, so thankfully she didn't become vice president. My God. But we still had to deal with her. And I fully believe that it's Sarah Palin and her brand of speaking that led to Donald Trump, because then they said, oh, it's okay to be an asshole and rude and ignorant and loud as long as you're really loud and really stupid.
Without a doubt. Yep. And she met all those criteria.
Yes, she did. All right. Yeah, I'm kind of pissed. I think I need to calm down a little bit. Yeah. All right, David. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Love you. Bye.
Love you too. So anyway, so it's a good thing, I guess, that I had to tape this morning with Bill Mumy, this afternoon, actually, and Angela Cartwright. We did it not too long ago. Other things happened today. It's just, you know, the interview went long, so we're going to run long today. So it'll be on the Progressive Voices Network, but at the top of the hour, the interview will probably still go on. So we'll keep it running at NicoleSandler.com, on the Listen Live page, on my stream at Nicole Sandler Stream, and all the video streams. So if you're enjoying it, stick around. It'll go for a while. We do some reminiscing and some talking, and don't talk politics at all. But there are a couple of other stories that I want to fill you in on before we get to that. Because I can't just do a show of fluff. Go figure. There was some very moving testimony today before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Simone Biles, Ali Raisman, Michaela, I forget her last name, and another women's gymnast who was an Olympic gymnast, testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the abuse they suffered at the hands of Larry Nassar and the reprehensible behavior by the FBI, who should have been protecting them. When I heard Simone Biles tell the story, and Ali Raisman, and they told their story to the FBI, who said, is that all? And then didn't hear from them for another 7 months while other women and children were being assaulted by this man who purported to be a doctor. I am sickened beyond comprehension. It is so disgusting. And the FBI needs to be completely rebuilt from the bottom up. From the bottom up, not the top down. Get rid of everybody at the top and start over again, because this is not okay. And then we have this reconciliation bill. You know, the thing they keep referring to is the $3.5 trillion bill. Well, that's over 10 years. And that is a minimum, because what it should have been, I didn't pull it. Bernie Sanders was on with Anderson Cooper last night, and he laid it all down. He said, look, originally, the majority of our caucus wanted $6 trillion, which is more in line with what we need. We already cut it, and we already negotiated, and the bottom line is $3.5 trillion over 10 years. Well, Congress is now marking up the bill, and more of these so-called Democrats are showing their loyalty to the almighty dollar over their constituents. And in this case, it's three conservative Dems, and do not call them moderates. They are not moderate, and they're not centrists. As Howie says, they're from the Republican wing of the Democratic Party. They took pharma money and voted against the provision that would allow Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices, thereby killing that part of the bill. So my friend Alex Lawson, who you've heard on the show, he's the executive director of Social Security Works, he put out a statement. And the three members of Congress, in case you're wondering, are Scott Peters of California, Kathleen Rice of New York, who's supposed, you know, now in leadership, and Kurt Schrader of Oregon. And as Alex says, they teamed up with Republicans to block Medicare drug price negotiations in the Energy and Commerce Committee. And his statement reads, it's disgusting when politicians who supported Medicare negotiation in the past switch their votes in exchange for pharma cash. But we won't let a few bought and paid for politicians stop the overwhelming will of the people. We are going to get Medicare negotiation into the Build Back Better package. We are going to pass it into law, and we are going to lower drug prices for everyone. Any politician standing in the way of lower drug prices is on a short path to losing their jobs. Sing it, Alex. See, I'm so riled up. So it is a really good thing that I had this interview booked today with Bill Mumy and Angela Cartwright. By the way, something I did not realize, and I didn't know until this morning, that it was 56 years ago today that Lost in Space premiered on television. It debuted 56 years ago today. And it only ran for 3 years, but it's one of those things larger than life. So are you ready to take it down a couple of notches and chill out, maybe laugh and reminisce? Because I certainly am. So I'll tell you what, let's, I need to do this. Hold on. I need to get our shot together. And I do, damn it. Where does that one come from? That and that, I don't know. Do that. Okay. I think there it is. I guess we'll find out soon enough. All right. So with no further ado, I guess we say this one. No, that's there. Oh, there it is. Okay. So with no further ado, I say, take it away, Nicole, and let's talk to Bill Mumy and Angela Cartwright. Dear old friend, and hopefully a new friend, somebody that I feel like I've known forever, but we're just meeting literally for the first time, Bill Mumy and Angela Cartwright. They are TV brother and sister from many, many years ago. But now, it's a lifetime later, and they're still working together. You guys have a new book out, Lost and Found in Space 2, making me believe that you've done this before.
Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Yes, a few years ago, 6 years ago, when the 50th anniversary of Lost in Space came around, we put out Lost and Found in Space Volume 1, which was largely a photograph memoir with some remembrances, but not a lot. This new volume, which came out yesterday, has over 350 pages, over 900 new photographs, mostly never seen before. And most importantly, I think, this time around, we've told the secrets, we've told the stories, we've told the stuff that people have been wanting us to tell for many, many, many decades. And so we figured, well, you know, we know where the bodies are and we're going to tell.
Cool. Well, that's fun. So did you work on this like during the pandemic while you're stuck at home, or is that you did it virtually? How did this all come together?
Well, it was our pandemic plan that we thought, well, you know, we're home. We had got access to all these new photographs from the archives of Lost in Space. The late Kevin Burns had called me and said, look, I got all these new pictures. You got to see them. And Bill and I went to the office and we're like, whoa, these are a lot of new pictures. And he gave us his blessing to do a volume 2 and include all of these. But what happened, because we were home, you know, Bill and I talked a lot and texted a lot and emailed a lot. And, he was coming up with stories and I was like, oh yeah. And then I'd come up with something. And that is what this book is made of. Not only all these new images, but new stories as well, you know, and memories.
Nice. Also, just so people who are interested, this is something you guys did together. Like, did you self-publish it? I know you can get it through AngelaCartwright.com and BillMumy.com. So is it, it's your, you did this?
Yeah. No.
No?
No, we have.
Well, it is self-published, but through Next Chapter Publishing. But the signed versions can be bought on Angela Cartwright Studio, and the unsigned versions are now available through Lulu. So you go to ncpbooks.com and it will direct you to where that ships globally around the world. The autographed copies, also we ship many places around the world.
Right. Okay. So yeah. I'm sorry, Bill, you were about to say something there.
Well, I wanted to say that, you know, since the 50th anniversary, there's been so much new Lost in Space energy. Both Angela and I appeared in the Netflix series, the current new Netflix series, and we've had a lot of great interaction with the producers and the cast of that show. So there was a lot of new things besides all of the personal appearances and events we've been to. The book also is a story about, you know, a 56, 57 year relationship between the two of us. I mean, we started out as, I hate to use the phrase, but it is applicable. We started out as child stars. We were the only people we went to school with for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
We went through puberty together. We dated each other and went through that stuff together. And we've collaborated on a lot of projects. Angela has done the design for many of my albums over the last 20 years, and we collaborated on a fantasy novel. So although the focus of the book is certainly Lost in Space, it's also our story.
Right. Now, you started working, you had both done projects before Lost in Space. Like, I was looking for some photos. First of all, Angela, you were in Make Room for Daddy with Danny Thomas. You were very young. How old were you here?
I was four. I'd done my first movie when I was three with Paul Newman. I played his daughter in Somebody Up There Likes Me. And then I got the Danny Thomas show that went for 7 seasons.
Wow. Wow.
So I kind of grew up in my childhood on that show. And yes. Went right into The Sound of Music afterwards.
The Sound of Music. So The Sound of Music and Lost in Space, weren't they both right around the same time, the first season of Lost in Space?
Sound of Music took a year to film and record and do all of that. And right after The Sound of Music ended, Lost in Space began. I was on the lot for a little while on the 20th Century Fox lot. And then Lost in Space started, and that went for 3 years.
And Bill, your first role was actually on a Twilight Zone, wasn't it?
I started quite a couple of years before the Twilight Zones. Well, I did do 3 of the original Twilight Zones. But yeah, I mean, Angela started at 3. I was a slacker. I didn't start till 5.
Oh, 5. Okay. So, but your first Twilight Zone, that was the phone call to your grandmother, right? On the toy phone?
Great show.
That was amazing. Yeah, in fact, I'm looking on Wikipedia, our source for everything, and they have in your television and filmography timeline, the first two roles they have are both on The Twilight Zone. The first is A Long Distance Call, and the second is It's a Good Life. But I guess you had done things before that. Anyway, you were the kid that we were all terrified of. And to this day, you know, people still wish people to the cornfield.
Well, yep. It's good that you brought that up, Nicole. It's real good. And you just keep thinking good thoughts about me and you'll stay out of the cornfield.
Oh, well, I always think good thoughts about you, Bill. You know that. And by the way, on my little wall o' sound here, I have this.
You're a bad man. You're a very bad man.
Yeah, because occasionally I need to use that to call people out. And something, you know, when I mentioned you were coming on the show and that we were old friends, listeners brought up, you know, he reprised that role years later with his daughter. And I do know that. In fact, let me share just the very beginning of It's Still a Good Life with, I guess this is Forrest Whitaker, who did this part of it. Here, let me bring this up. And it starts off like this.
Rod Serling introduced us to a monster. Monster so powerful he was able to make the world disappear just by using his mind.
Ooh.
For the residents of Peeksville, Ohio, a nightmare had begun. The monster knew their every thought, could feel their every emotion, and when they made him angry, which was often, he would banish them into a cornfield from which there was no return.
Dear.
The most interesting thing about this monster was that he was only 6 years old.
Look at you.
Aw, little Billy.
40 years later, and the people of Peeksville are still in hell.
Ooh.
Oh, yes, there's one other thing. The monster now has a child of his own. And though she possesses none of her father's powers, he still loves her.
Wow.
Very, very much.
Audrey, I'm bored. Let's calm down.
All right.
Okay.
So there is your daughter Liliana, who followed in your footsteps and was able to, you know, be your the scene where they morph from your face to hers is astounding, because she looks just like you.
Well, so is Bill's grandkids too, look exactly like Bill.
I've seen them.
It was a great treat to return to the character of Anthony Fremont 40 years later, especially alongside Cloris Leachman, who was just, you know, such a fantastic actress and human being, and really bumped up your game. If you worked with Cloris, you had to bring your best stuff because she wouldn't accept anything less. And the fact that Liliana, you know, starred in that project along with Cloris and myself made that just the best experience. And I thought she did Liliana did a great job in that.
She really did. Now, I remember when your son, Seth, was in a movie when he was little, and then he got out of it. And then Liliana started, and she was in the Santa Claus 2 and 3. She was in a bunch of movies. Is she still acting?
She has been in animation voiceover work without a break since she was 7, and she's 27. She's never not had at least one major animation series on the air in all those years. Right now, she co-stars in the number one show on Nickelodeon called The Loud House, and they're in their like 6th season, and they just did a feature film as well. So yeah, she's a busy gal, but she prefers to be on the microphone side like yourself and not really anymore. You know, when she was about 15, she had to do like a makeout scene. She was doing a television series and she had to make out with this boyfriend of hers on it. And it made her uncomfortable. It just did. And it made her real boyfriend at the time very kind of like, I don't want you doing that. And
wow.
Kind of led into the voiceover arena.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, you know, you said she's 27 and it blew my mind, but you know what? My daughter Allison is 22. And so I guess this is she slept in Liliana's crib. So here's the story. When I adopted Allison, I adopted her from Kazakhstan, Angela, but Bill and Eileen were dear friends, and she was already a toddler. She was 18 months old when I brought her home, and I thought, it's kind of a waste to get a crib because she's not going to sleep in it that long. And Bill or Eileen, one of them, said, Liliana's crib. You can use Liliana's crib. And sure enough, so Allison and I, when the Santa Claus 2 came out, Allison was little, and we were at the movie theater, and she knew who you were, and I said, that's Liliana. That's whose crib you slept in. So every time she'd see her, she's like, I slept in her crib. So that's...
Well, there's a real Hollywood story.
We're filled with them.
Slept in her bed.
But you know what? You. So this is our brush with fame. But I got one of my best stories ever. That you'd want to talk about a Hollywood story is through you, Bill. One year, you guys took me along with you and Seth. Liliana wasn't born yet, to a Christmas party at Miguel Ferrer's mother's house. Now, Miguel Ferrer, obviously a dear friend of yours who passed away a few years ago. You guys were in a band together, The Generators, that we loved. Miguel's mother is Rosemary Clooney. And so you take me to her house. Seth, your son must have been maybe 3 or 4. And I went in the kitchen to get a drink. And Rosemary is sitting at the kitchen table with Seth. And this is the scene I walked in on. She's telling him about Santa Claus. And she just breaks into song. She's like, you better watch out. You better not cry. And I'm thinking, oh my God. What I wish I had a cat. I'm seeing Rosemary Clooney sing Santa Claus is Coming to Town to my friend Bill Mumy's little son Seth. This I couldn't write this scene, and I'm living it, and that's a moment that has stayed with me all these years. Bill, it's one of my like top 10 moments. It was incredible.
We had at least 20 Christmas Eves at Rosemary's house. Mm-hmm. It was a dear friend, as you know. Yeah. And Christmas Eve parties were pretty amazing. I mean, Tony Bennett would show up. The piano that Rosemary owned, and it was George Gershwin's piano.
Oh, wow.
Nothing like going to George Gershwin's piano and playing fish heads, okay? those were wonderful parties, and I miss Rosemary and Miguel very much, and I cherish those memories. I'm glad you were there.
Oh, my God, and I thank you for that. That was one of those once-in-a-lifetime moments, and something that, you know, that's my story. Oh, my God, at Rosemary Clooney's house, hearing her serenade Little Seth Mumy with a private rendition of Santa Claus Coming to Town. I was like, can I pinch myself? It was pretty amazing. But you both grew up around these famous people. So Angela, you know, I'm looking at old footage from The Sound of Music. Oh, my God, Julie Andrews. Did you realize at the time, like, who you were working with then? Or did you know?
Well, Julie had just finished Mary Poppins. And she was, just coming out. And so she wasn't a star when she did The Sound of Music. Everybody knew that she would be, except her. And we all adored her. We would sit and she would sing to us. Talking about people singing, Julie Andrews used to sing to us, taught me how to say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious backwards, which I can still do.
Nice.
Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. That was taught from Julie Andrews. And, you know, I remember we were doing the boat scene where we all fall in the water and we were sitting around, it was freezing cold. We were all sitting around sipping brandy, I might say, but nobody knew that at the time, that little secret, but we were freezing. And Julie, we were dancing, trying to keep warm and stuff like that. And the Variety came out to say that Mary Poppins, she had won the Academy Award. And so we were there. She was, of course, in Salzburg at the time. So, yeah, it was a different childhood for sure. And, you know, we grew up around some pretty cool people.
Oh, without a doubt. I can imagine the stories. In fact, I was looking for a clip from Sound of Music. Let me just very briefly, we'll share. I don't have that boat scene, but I do have your turn here.
Time to go.
I'm glad to go. I cannot tell a lie. I flit, I float, I fleetly flee, I fly.
Nice dancing.
Yeah.
So that must have been, I mean, do you watch it? Can you go back and watch your old work, both of you, now?
Well, I don't sit down and watch it, but every year they have the Sound of Music sing-along at the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh, wow.
And we're invited to that. My kids, who, my daughter's 40, and, you know, they're grown up, and they have families of their own. They love that night. And so we take the whole family and go and watch it on the big screen and boo and hiss and sing-along. And it's a great time. So I would say I do see the movie yearly. I see something new, a nuance of Christopher Plummer's every time I watch it.
Uh-huh.
My grandkids, they love watching the movie, but I don't sit down and you know, I've seen it probably a million times. This is a movie that doesn't go away. I mean, it's been around for a long time and people still love it so much and it brings so much happiness. So,
well, yeah,
it's cool to be part of something like that. It really is.
Bill, now you've got two young grandchildren. I see the pictures all over Facebook. They're adorable. Did they know? I mean, did they see old tapes of you on Lost in Space or on, did they have any idea about the showbiz connection or it's just your grandpa?
No. I mean, you know, if they can get through 10 or 15 minutes of Elmo on Sesame Street, you've won for 15 minutes. Not yet. I mean, Presley is 2 years old and 2 and 9 months. And Isla's only 10 months old.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Their attention span to things like that. I would imagine the first experiences to that kind of stuff will probably be watching their father on Three Wishes, you know, mm-hmm. or on the films that he did when he was very young, maybe Liliana's stuff. But I guess eventually Lost in Space will be something appropriate for them to laugh and tease me about.
Right. So now you, Bill, you've been keeping busy all these years. You alluded a moment ago, you talked about Barnes and Barnes and Fish Heads, but you've been making music all along. In fact, when I was looking at pictures, I found a picture of you as Will Robinson with a guitar. So were you playing music when you were young? I mean, when did your love of music begin?
Oh, well, my love of music began when I started to exist, but my musicianship began right around the time of Lost in Space. Will Robinson played guitar in six or seven scenes in Lost in Space over the series run. And, you know, I had to sing a few silly things that were public domain, but, you know, to please Irwin Allen, because he didn't have to pay for the license. But no, the music has always been a really, my most passionate part of my life, I think. Barnes and Barnes have a new album coming out on Demented Punk November 5th called Cake Dream. It's a pretty theatrical, kind of a Twilight Zone-ish type record. And I'm just finishing the 13th. There are 13 tracks on the album. I just finishing editing the 13th video for that. So it's a complete package.
You've been busy too. Oh, let me just say that during Lost in Space, it was a very heavy music time. I mean, the Beatles, you know, I was a total Beatle freak, and there was lots of singing. Marta used to love to sing. So it was that era, you know, of great music. We talk a bit about that in the book, don't we, Bill?
We talk a lot about that in the book. I was the only one in the cast who had a stereo record player in my dressing room, that's how important music was to me even when I was 10. And so Angela would bring in British Invasion albums, and we would, you know, listen to all of the Merseybeat bands. I would bring in at that time mostly Kingston Trio and Pete Seeger and Peter Paul and Mary stuff. I was the Weavers. I was kind of a folky snob. Marta brought in folk rock stuff like the Byrds and Bob Dylan, and Mark Goddard brought in Broadway musicals and some Richie Havens and stuff. Anyway, we do go into that in the book, but I did have a stereo in my dressing room, and so all of the cast.
And we went to lots of concerts too. Bill and I.
Funny, you can remember how to say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, but you can't remember when we went to see Jimi Hendrix together.
You know, I do. We went to Hollywood Bowl. We went to Whiskey a Go Go. Yeah, we did that. I remember that. And the Devonshire Downs.
Where we started.
A lot of memories come back. It's what's so interesting about something like this book. It's like going through your senior school album, because all of a sudden you look at pictures, and I've always believed this. I'm a huge picture lover. Photographs, you know, they say a thousand words. You remember, things are triggered from looking at photos. And that's why the book, Lost and Found in Space, too, is so, you know, heavy with photos, but also the memories that those triggered. And we were actually, because it was during the pandemic, able to kind of sit back and take the time to kind of think of those times. You know, Bill has an elephant's memory. He really does. For me, it's a little more teasing, you know, as far as, you know, where in the files it is. But a lot came back, I must say. A lot of memories.
But you've been through this before, too. You did the first book, and now you did a second book, and you had a whole new slew of memories come up?
Yeah. There was a multitude of unseen photographs. And again, the first volume of the book, which did really well and we were very pleased with, was mostly snippets of memories. This is detailed stories. Our first musical experiences together, I know that Angela had you know, performed musically in Sound of Music, and she had performed quite amazingly on the Danny Thomas Show, singing and dancing and stuff there.
About when okay.
When I was 10 years old and Angela was 11 and a half, it was before her 12th birthday, we actually played the Hollywood Bowl in our silver outfits.
Our spacesuits.
It was Scout Day. And the Hollywood Bowl was packed with Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, Cub Scouts, and Brownies. And we each separately, not like Sonny and Cher, but we walked out there and in our silver spacesuits and performed. That was my very first musical gig, Nicole. It's been down since.
Now, the guy saying, "Let there be peace on earth," and Bill saying, "Tijuana Jail." So appropriate, don't you think?
For how old were you? 8?
No, she goes out there and sings, you know, "Let there be peace on earth." I went out there and sang the Tijuana Jail, a song about going down to Mexico, getting drunk, getting into trouble, gambling, and being thrown in jail. And nobody suggested to me, "Hey, Billy, why don't you sing like 'This Land Is Your Land' instead?" Nobody's thinking. So that's the song that I chose to perform at the Hollywood Bowl. And you can see how twisted my mind has been for a long time.
Well, of course. Now, musically, you've gone on, you've recorded all these years in between gigs. You know, you went on, you did Babylon 5, I think, was your last full-time series show, right? How many years was Babylon 5 on the air?
5 years. We did 120 Babylon 5s. And yeah, after wearing that alien makeup for 5 years, I was a little burnt out. Didn't really want to go through that again. I've done plenty of on-camera stuff since then. And I've been a producer of the History Channel's series Ancient Aliens for... I'm starting my 5th season now, but the show... 14th season. So, I mean, I'm still very much involved in television and music, but, you know, it's a strange time because of our unfortunate global pandemic. And I'm very COVID cautious. You know, I've stayed home. I've written a ton of music, a ton of, you know, the book and other projects, videos as well. And I've been lucky to create. I have a recording studio in my house. I can play all these instruments, and that's what I've been doing.
You're in your house. That's a room in your house. Do you still have the secret Pez dispenser room?
I do. Well, I can show you. Yes, I could walk you over to it if you'd like.
You could? Oh, I would love to. So it's like a secret hidden room behind the wall in the living room that it opens up, and it's this hidden room. And
yeah, I'm not gonna show you that, but I will show you the Pez wall. Like, brought it up. Okay, here's the Pez display.
Oh wow! Oh, so that's not the same room.
No,
that's not the secret room. So you moved the Pez display from the. I always thought about that secret room but the Pez. Look at those. They're all Pez dispensers.
Collecting for a long time. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
This big time showbiz here.
That's right. That's right. And guitars. And so you can see. So those of you who are listening on an audio feed or an audio stream are missing because we're seeing Bill's studio there. So the room you're in has the walls lined with guitars, but the whole house, like the stairways and everything, were lined with guitars. Are they still all over the place?
Yep.
They might. They might be. You know.
Yeah.
it makes me nervous, Nicole.
Oh, I'm sorry. Telling people. You've got a lot of guitars.
I do. I use them all. We are in my recording studio right now, so that's why the instruments.
And I'm in my art room, which is just a complete mess, but that's, you know, what we did during the pandemic. We created, kept artful, and it's a good thing.
Yeah, I started painting during the pandemic. You can see I've lately been playing with like faux stained glass. That's what's behind me. But I started painting pet portraits, go figure. I hadn't picked up a paintbrush since I was like 12 years old. And now at 60, I learned that I have a talent and I started painting. So that's what I've been doing in my spare time. Bill, at the beginning, I'm sorry?
What?
Can't hear you.
No, you keep breaking up. Say again.
I've seen your artwork on social media, and I think it's fabulous.
Thank you. And so this is my pandemic silver lining. I never thought I could draw, and I still can't draw, but somehow I can paint, and I've been creative. So it's bringing, you know, it's brought that out of me. We also went vegan. I've been cooking. So that's what I've been doing, staying at home. But Bill, I don't, at the beginning of the pandemic, You do these Monday music, Moomy music moments on Facebook where you play a song. And near the beginning of the pandemic, you did an original song that I loved. If you've seen me looking off to the side, I've been trying to find it on my computer and I can't. But it was Social Distancing Now. Do you remember that?
Yeah, Social Distancing Blues.
Yes.
I'm in a band, although, of course, during the pandemic, nobody's gigging. But I'm in a band called Action Skulls with Vicki Peterson from the Bangles and John Cowsill from the Cowsill and Love's Beach Boys. And I wrote and we recorded via file sharing an album called A Different World that was released I guess the pandemic, we started lockdown around March. The album was released, I think, in June. So it might be the first album that was completely thematically focused on the changing world because of the pandemic. But that song is on that album, A Different World by Action Skulls, and can be found.
I will have to look for it because I texted you, I think, and I said, can I play that on my show? Because it was so good. And you said yes, so I did. And now I can't find it because I don't know when it was. But
Really, yeah, please play it. Check out that album. It's an interesting thing that fell together very spontaneously.
Say again the name of the band?
Action Skull.
Action
Skull. Okay.
Action. Yeah. You know, when we have a third album coming out next year, it's almost finished. And you know, when we were putting the band together, John Cowsill said, I would like to call the band Action Figures. And I said, I'd like to call the band Peace Skulls. And okay, we'll be Action Skulls. And Vicki thought we were kidding. And then it just stuck. You know, it's kind of weird coming up with names for bands.
You know, interesting you should bring up the Cowsills. There's a Cowsills documentary, I think, on Netflix or one of them that I was watching the other night. And they were like the Partridge Family before the Partridge Family. So you're growing up, you know, around a lot of other kids who grew up in the business. I guess you've known the Cowsills since they were younger, right, too. And so is it weird? I mean, there it is. I see it on Spotify. We may have to play it at the end. Social Distancing Blues. I found it. I multitask. So you grew up around a lot of other child stars, both of you, and you both came out okay. We've heard so many horror stories about child actors who live a really rough life. You avoided that. How? Because that's not a normal life, right, for a kid to grow up in.
I just didn't get busted. I was just lucky.
He wasn't that bad a guy.
Thank you, dude.
Go on. We can't kind of hear you, actually, Bill. You're kind of breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, you break up.
So I'll take this. Growing up, I was born in England. My parents were very British, and I still had to make my bed and I still had to take my plate to the kitchen sink when I was done. And, you know, I wasn't like a little star at home. My parents were loving and caring and they stayed married and, you know, they were married 65 years, I think it was. Anyway, I think a lot had to do with that. You know, today there's so many kids that are in show business and they know what it's about and they think they know what they want. And, you know, it can just be very confusing and everything. You know, we certainly had experiences that normal kids did not have. It was tough going back to school for, you know, I just went for a little while in my senior year.
Wow.
So, you know, there were little things like that, but, you know, I don't know. Our lives were different.
Yeah. You know, when
I first the scary stuff, let's put it that way.
When I first met Bill, we first met back in the early 90s when I was producing the Mark and Brian show. And you were, at that time, you were doing Babylon 5, but you were also in this band called The Generators, we mentioned with Miguel Ferrer, and David Jolliffe, who those old people like us will might remember Room 222, who just lost one of their stars last week. But Michael Constantine, right? Is that his name? Yeah. But so, you know, yeah, but you keep breaking up. I don't know. I don't know why either. Oh, no. Is that better? No.
No, that's not better. I think you're in the Twilight Zone.
Maybe. But anyway, so David Jolliffe, still in the business, doing a lot of voiceover work. Miguel Ferrer obviously grew up in the business with his mother, Rosemary Clooney. So I guess you grew up with the group of showbiz kids who didn't, you know, fall off the deep end. Or maybe it's overblown that so many child actors have a rough time later in life, I guess, when they can't make the transition to be an adult actor.
Well, I think a lot of the kid. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
I think a lot of the child actors that had sad endings, you know, were mistreated by the system and by their families, and they didn't. They came of age, and they didn't have any money saved for them, or very little money saved for them. Maybe they weren't that necessarily interested in acting, or maybe they didn't have that much talent, and they couldn't stay in the business. I'll tell you one thing that I think that is pretty true for everyone that I know and Ange knows, that are both positive and negative. It's difficult when you're on a film or a program that, let's say, 40, 50 million people watched every week, yeah. A new episode, not just like, say, the classic Sound of Music, but every week a new 50, 40 million people watch Lost in Space or Danny Thomas or Leave it to Beaver or the Donna Reed Show or Father Knows Best or My Three Sons or, you know, I mean, you could go on a long list of different shows. But when that goes away, it's hard to kind of find something that makes you feel as important as that did. And I think that causes a lot of people to be depressed or dissatisfied. You know, nowadays there's countless channels and internet opportunities and streaming and, you know, obviously digital recording. But back in the 60s, when we were prolifically working as children, you know, there was none of that. So people just waited a week to watch your next episode. Right. And there were only three networks, you know, that was it. You didn't have any other choices. So we had an audience of 40, 50 million people every week. And, as did other child actors of the era. And when that's no longer a reality, it's kind of hard to be satisfied for a lot of people to feel their self-worth as good as they did then.
Well, sure. And I'm guessing part of it has to do with when you're a child star and you're adorable, as you both were, some kids outgrow the adorableness and they go through that awkward stage and maybe they don't get any more roles. That's got to play tricks on your head and screw with you. And when you have the world at your feet when you're little and then all of a sudden you're not so cute anymore and that goes away. Thankfully, you both stayed so cute and kept the role.
Well, I think Bill's, you know, savior was music. Yeah. And, you know, mine was photography and art. And, you know, when you are three and you've been working since you were three, it's, you know, all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, I've been there. So what's ahead? You know, I kind of went backwards. I modeled for years. And then, you know, I wanted to be on the other side of the camera. And I was a photographer for years. So, you know, I think it's finding that other thing, what joy brings you joy and what you enjoy doing. You know, did we love going to the set every day? That was our life. We didn't know any different. But I think also a tight family is very important, not only in showbiz, but in life itself to make human beings that are, you know, worthwhile human beings that bring something to the world.
Right. Now, Angela, your older sister was also an actress.
Yes, Veronica Cartwright. done a million things. She's a real chameleon. Probably things you've seen that you didn't even know it was her. Huh. And she has continued to work in, you know, major roles all these years. So she loves it and she keeps working. We kind of decided to maybe put it on the back burner. It's not that we're out of it. It's just that we maybe choose to do other things that fulfill our lives as well.
Sure. But nostalgia is big. Again, we're speaking with Bill Mumy and Angela Cartwright. They have a new book out. It's Lost and Found in Space 2. And this one, so I've seen the book looks beautiful. I mean, here's the front cover. Let me put up here. I have with some pictures of you guys with it. And then, and the back cover. Oh, you've got one you're holding up right there. And so it's a big book, right? Filled with a lot of photographs, but you're saying a lot of stories too. Give us one of the stories, something that we don't know that's fun that people will hear about in the book.
Well, we do share some stories about some pranks that were pulled on the set and perhaps a little romance that was going on. One of the things that's important to remember is for me and Angela, and for everyone involved with the show, Lost in Space was a very happy place. Mm. You know, it wasn't an unpleasant set where people were unhappy and fighting with each other or throwing, you know, shit fits. It was a happy place. And 50 some years later, Lost in Space is still seen all around the world and it still continues to make people happy. So being a part of something that brings happiness to people, whether that's in a nostalgic way, for people of our age, or whether that's in a fantasy, campy, humorous way for the third or fourth generation of people watching Lost in Space, it's a good feeling to know that, you know, what you've done is and makes people happy.
Without a doubt. I mean, I've got a picture up here of the whole Lost in Space cast, and again, I haven't seen it recently, but it takes me back. What? 50 years?
It's on MeTV. Yeah, it is. It's running again.
Uh-huh.
And so there's a whole new generation watching it.
Right. And then there's been the reboots, you said. So, Bill, did you play Dr. Smith?
Yes. I played the real Dr. Smith. Parker Posey plays the poser Dr. Smith. And Angela plays Parker Posey's mother. So it's great to be connected to the new show, and they've shown nothing but love and affection and nudge, nudge, wink, winks to the classic series. And they were very generous and sweet. And it was the production value of the Netflix show is beautiful to see. And the tone of the show is very similar to the original Lost in Space that Irwin Allen created and sold to the networks. And we were aired originally in what CBS had called their family hour. And after about 6 or 7 episodes of Lost in Space aired, CBS was told, you know, it's scaring the little kids. And they made us kind of change the tone a bit. So it became campier and funnier and less dangerous. But it really, the first handful of Lost in Space, if you see them with music scored by John Williams and this great black and white photography that we had, it's a really cool and oftentimes dark early tone to the series.
I don't know if that would scare kids today in the same way.
Probably not.
Movies with like Star Wars and stuff like that, you know, but at that time it was pretty dark and maybe just scary. Our aliens were certainly, you know, not painted orange and stuff like that in the first season. Later, it got pretty campy.
Now, in the first season was black and white, right? And then the other two were in color. So it was a big change from the first to the second.
Yes.
Huge change. It was, you know, it was the psychedelic 60s. The show was 65 through 68. Wow. And if you think about pop culture change, the music that the Beatles were creating, the demonstrations against the war. Richard Nixon was on Laugh-In. I mean, it was a very brief period of mod, pop, art, psychedelia. And Lost in Space really encompasses all of those shifts in the culture. We were talking about, you know, the bloop, Debbie the Bloop, the chimpanzee with the headset on her head to have those elongated ears. And I couldn't help but think about the fact that here we were, I was 11, Angela was 12, and here we were holding this, we loved Debbie the Bloop, but here we were holding this chimpanzee, and you'd rehearse a little scene with her. And then when you shot it, all of a sudden there were explosions going off everywhere. Smoke, all of our effects were practical effects. Huh. Nothing was done. So here's Angela holding this monkey, and all of a sudden there's a bomb exploding behind her. There's sparks coming from above. There's smoke and flames, and everybody's falling down left and right. You know, That monkey, she could have ripped our faces off. And I actually don't know if kids would be allowed to experience something like that today. I don't think they'd be, but I mean, we never had a bad time with Debbie the Bloop filming with her. But when I look back on that and all the effects and the explosions that we constantly dealt with on the show, it was dangerous.
I'll bet. Yeah. Those times were different, right?
Rings of fire and, you know, just explosions. And our special effects guy, you know, he only had four fingers on one hand. So it wasn't that encouraging. But, well, yeah, that was
we do. We talk about that in the book. The special effects guy's name was Stu Moody. And Jonathan Harris, Dr. Smith, was very, very cautious, didn't ever want to really get hurt. He never did, but he would always, when there was explosions, which were every day, he would before they would shoot it, he would turn to Stu Moody and he would say, "Well, Moody, is it safe?" And Stu Moody would like go, "Okie." It's like show him the okie dokie sign, but his fingers were all blown off. And Jonathan would go, "Oh dear, oh the pain."
And speaking of Jonathan, and when you're talking about Debbie being so well mannered as a chimp, I mean, she was a wild animal, but oh my God, she had a great temperament. I loved her. We had a llama that was supposed to be on that show, and that was a spitting llama. And actually, Jonathan got that llama fired. But that story's in the book, so you're going to have to get the book to get that story. Right, Bill?
Indeed, that is right, dear Angela.
Now, the book you cannot get. It's not on Amazon or at your local bookstore. So to get it, it's ncpbooks.com, or go to billmoomy.com or angelacartwright.com, and you have links to where, and you can get a special autographed the deluxe edition or the regular edition, which is still pretty deluxe.
Well, the regular edition, which is if you go to ncpbooks.com, that will take you to where you can order just the book, not signed.
Okay. Gotcha.
And that's shipped all globally, all over the world. The AngelaCartwrightStudio.com.
Angela Cartwright Studio.
Purple Books there, and just click on that. And you can get an autographed copy, of which Bill and I are trying desperately to get all of them signed and get them shipped out as soon as possible. So I better get going so that I can actually start on that today. That's my job today.
Oh, boy. All right. So you're busy. It's so great to meet you. And, Bill, I miss you guys. I mean, my Moomies, I used to see you all the time, and now I'm on the other side of the country, and I do miss you. And you were, you know, dear friends. And so I cherish that, and I just want to let you know that I miss you.
It's great to be with you, Nicole. We miss you too. Send you our love and hang tough.
Yeah, you too. You too.
Nice meeting you, Nicole.
Nice meeting you as well. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a treat, and you know, it would be nice if we could do it in person, maybe one of these years again.
Absolutely.
All right. I'm going to play Social Distancing Blues from Action Skulls, but you know. people should explore. First of all, go to Bill Mumy's Facebook page and get those Monday Mumy musical moments and all this other stuff, because you share a lot of your creativity with everybody. And so it's there. And AngelaCartwrightStudios.com, we can see a lot of your work as well. So we get older and we keep creating, just maybe in different ways.
Yep.
That's absolutely. Right.
Hang in there, folks.
Okay. You too. Thank you so much. Angela, it's great meeting you, Bill. Love you. Send my love to Eileen too, please, and the kids. And there you go.
So I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. So I did find the song that Bill wrote right at the beginning of the pandemic. He put it up on Facebook, just him, you know, himself. But this is the band version done by Action Skulls. It's Bill Mumy and Action Skulls. Take it away, and I'll see you guys tomorrow. Thanks for hanging. Bye.
Well, hello, people. What a crazy scene. Here we all are in quarantine. Let's not be foolish. Let's do what's best. Try taking deep breaths. Get lots of rest. 'Cause we're social distancing now, but someday soon, I hope, we'll be dancing together again. Meanwhile, wash lots of soap. Don't be cranky, don't freak out, cough into a hanky. Try not to pout. 'Cause we're social distancing now, but someday soon, I hope, we'll be dancing together again. Meanwhile, wash lots of soap. Catch up on reading, watch TV, maybe Lost in Space, featuring me. Listen to some music, yoga's good. Stay hydrated like you always should. Because we're social distancing now, but someday soon, I hope, we'll be dancing together again. Meanwhile, wash lots of soap. One of these weeks, months or days, things will go back to normal, insane ways. And then something new will come along, and we'll do it all again.